The 1960s and 70s were a period of intense student militancy, protest against the Vietnam War, Black Power, and the women's and gay liberation movements. It was, or so the story goes, a period of new social movements at a time when the working class proved to be passive at best and conservative at worst, epitomized by the incident in New York City in 1970 when construction workers organized by the AFL-CIO were sent to attack anti-war protesters. But is the picture of hard hats versus peaceniks truly emblematic of that era? Or was something incredibly profound and inspirational going on? A massive rank-and-file uprising and strike wave across this country, often led by Black, Latino, and female workers, defying accommodationist unions that has somehow managed to be written out of the history books. That's the contention of a new book co-edited by Aaron Brenner, Robert Brenner, and Cal Winslow titled Rebel Rank-and-File, Labor Militancy and Revolt from Below During the Long 1970s, published by Verso Books. This past weekend, I had the opportunity to speak with Cal Winslow in KPFA's Berkeley studios. He's a labor historian and the director of the Mendocino Institute. And I was joined on the phone from Detroit by one of the leaders of an iconic movement from that era, the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, which organized militant Black workers. His name is Mike Hamlin. I began by asking Cal Winslow to compare the upsurge of what he and his co-authors call the long 1970s, the years 1965 to 1981, with earlier periods of U.S. labor militancy.
The strike figures, statistics for 1970, 1974, 1976 rank with the great working class uprisings of earlier periods, 1919, 1934, the period following World War II. There were tens of thousands of major strikes in these years, and they certainly got the attention of the authorities if they didn't haven't gotten the attention of the historians.
In this hour, we'll talk about some of the specifics, the different sectors that participated in these strikes, but just perhaps give us a sense of the immensity of this strike wave. How many workers were involved in some of these strikes? How many strikes occurred? What were the peak years of this amazing upsurge of militancy?
Right. Well, we're talking mostly about the 70s, but looking back a little bit before my time, I was involved in these years, but a little bit before my time, in 1965 in Philadelphia, truck drivers, in defiance of their union and the city, literally shut the city down. They blockaded the major highways in and out of Philadelphia. They shut down the town hall a number of times. But coming closer to our period, let me just give you a couple of examples. In 1968, the gangster-led International Longshoremen's Union, which
is on the East Coast,
shut down the ports in what was then the longest strike in longshore history, only surpassed in 1972 when the West Coast longshoremen shut down the West Coast ports in defiance of their leader, Harry Bridges. So there are two examples. Let me briefly run through some more. 1970. There was the postal wildcat strike of 200,000 workers, I think probably still the biggest wildcat strike in our history. 1974, independent truckers in the midst of the gas crisis of that winter parked their rigs on the nation's major highways, say on the Delaware Memorial Bridge, where they virtually shut down Interstate 95, the connecting link to all the East Coast cities. Where I lived in Ohio, truckers parked their rigs on the Ohio Turnpike by Cleveland and also by Toledo, which cut off Detroit from the rest of the country. They shut these highways down. In a sense, they were kind of like a sit-in. They were sitting in their workplace, the highways. It was interesting that I remember factory workers left their jobs in Toledo to go out and find out what was going on the highways. We have two national miners' strikes, one in 74. 1974, the other in 78. Long, hard-fought militant struggles in 78. Three miners were killed, thousands were arrested, and they fought off the coal operators who people didn't always know this. The coal industry then was dominated by major international energy corporations. They fought these operators to a standstill in the late 70s. Hundreds, probably thousands of teachers' strikes took place, so that in that particular area in education, and based on a grassroots movement of striking militant action, about a million workers, teachers, joined the NEA in that decade. Really astounding when you think about it, but it was a militant grassroots movement. Again, my own experience in Ohio, at one point in Canton, 400 teachers were arrested in one strike, 230 in one swoop at Timken High School. David Montgomery, one of our mentors in labor history in this country, said that it was quite astounding in the late 60s to see teachers and hospital workers and garbage collectors being carted off to jail for violating injunctions. And he called it, and he recalled that people called it a new unionism, something new what was happening. And as much as anything else, the whole movement, the labor movement, the left in particular, the student left, was electrified by the emergence of the revolutionary movements in Detroit, which I think Mike is going to talk about. Wildcat strikes,
By wildcat strikes, you mean strikes that are not authorized by the union.
Not authorized by the UAW, bringing the civil rights movement into the north, into the heart of capitalism, really. Detroit was one of the industrial cities of history, of the world, and right within it, the belly of the beast, people would say that. Right in the heart of this giant city, these revolutionary union movements developed.
So what were the origins of this mass movement of union militancy? Much of it in defiance, not simply of the bosses, but in fact of the unions that existed. In the 1950s and the 1960s, you had what has been termed business unionism, and that was the context in which these movements rose out of. So perhaps you can start by defining what business unionism was about and how these movements reacted to it.
Well, Dave Beck, one of the Teamster leaders in the 1960s, said, hey, a union is just a business. We're just running a business. We offer some services to our workers and, to our members in exchange for their dues. I'm a businessman. George Meany, the head of the AFL-CIO through many of these years, boasted he'd never been on strike in his life. He'd never ordered anyone on strike. He'd never supported a strike. We had a group of people in the aftermath of the witch hunts of the McCarthy period, the anti-communism that swept the labor movement in following World War II. We had a period of history where these labor leaders basically struck a deal with the devil, and in their own mind, they considered themselves to be, or they wanted to consider themselves to be on par with the employers, to be partners in labor and government, to always have a seat at the table. And while there was prosperity, this worked to a certain degree. Labor leaders were able, without having to call out the rank and file in their support, were able to win for industrial workers, and particularly rising real wages, increasing benefits, more holidays, but at a price. And the price that what they gave back to the employers was the promise of labor peace, of steady production in a strong economy.
So what changed? What shifted in the 60s that gave birth to this phenomenal rise of militancy. Although, as you note, the 1950s were not a period without strikes.
Well, there were lots of reasons. They all came together, I think we might say, in the late 60s. But workers, my reading is that workers in the 1950s, and at a time when for many workers, for the industrial workers who were organized into unions, when there was pretty much full employment, wages were going up, the companies were doing well. Workers took advantage of that by being combative, by being confident, by being aggressive. And as you said, there were militant strikes in the 1950s, the great 1959 steel strike. So workers took advantage of these kinds of conditions and in the process became confident, combative in their own ability, their power, even though this was not often spelled out in what we think of political terms. So then when things began to change in the 1960s, they began to change with this background of a confident working class. They also began to change, and we'll get to this later again in when Mike's talking about Detroit, but in the expansion of the 1960s, literally millions of young people came into industry, into an expanding industry. And the young people, but in particular black workers, came into a industry where they were able to get jobs, but often the worst jobs. In difficult situations, in dangerous jobs, in heavy industry in particular, but also in mining and trucking and so forth. So you have a situation where the composition of the workforce is changing as well. We think that profitability began to change in the middle of the 60s, the problems with inflation, the employers became less able or less willing to kind of grant the concessions they had granted to the business unionisms in the heyday of the 1950s. And I think one thing above all became an issue for this period of time, and that was what workers called the speed up.
Tell us about that.
Well, again, in my own personal experience in Ohio, General Motors built a big, giant new plant in Northeast Ohio called Lordstown, where they boasted that they had the fastest assembly lines in the world. And if you just think about it for a minute, well, what is this going to mean for the people who are working on these assembly lines? And so that was kind of, you know, the speeding up of the work process, the speeding up of the assembly lines. We still have lots of United Parcel workers around. United Parcel workers in their brown trucks and their uniforms, you know, people probably today will recognize it, certainly did then, the supervisor riding along with them with the stopwatch in his hand, timing every move that they made. In a modern times kind of scenario, how long it took them to pick up the package, get out the door, get to the, and so on. In mining, there was a tremendous pressure on the miners to increase production. So, and with teachers and city workers and so forth, the teachers complained that they didn't have enough time to do their work properly and so forth. So right across the working class, there was this feeling that they were being pushed, pressured, forced to work harder, forced to work longer hours. So that became a really big issue. And so while economic issues were, I think, always important, and all, as far as I can see, as long as we have industrial capitalism, will always be important. Economic issues were certainly important, but often they didn't seem to be the major issues that people were protesting or taking action about. People, there were issues that came from, and this is another aspect, from the rest of the movements of the time, even if they didn't come directly with individual people, but the Southern civil rights demand for dignity. That demand ended up on picket signs all over the country. Auto workers want to humanize working conditions. miners and truck drivers democratize in the sense, you know, reminding us of the Students for a Democratic Society and participatory democracy, Miners for Democracy, Teamsters for Democracy. Women demanded access to work and equal pay. Blacks demanded access to work and fair, equal treatment. You mentioned stereotypes about workers and the war. Industry was filling up with young men coming back from Vietnam who, to be honest, were often angry, militant, and they became, in oftentimes, the shock troops, I think, of, we'll see what Mike says, shock troops of the Revolutionary Union movement, certainly of the coal miners movement, and right through, industry, so that people who looking back on it, you might suspect, well, these people would have been patriotic and conservative because of their experience in Vietnam. Often it was just the opposite.
Today we're looking back to the wave of militancy that shook this country in the late 1960s and 1970s, coming from the working class, often in defiance of the union hierarchy. And we're discussing the book Rebel Rank and File, Labor Militancy and Revolt from Below During the Long 70s. And with me in studio is Cal Winslow, one of the editors of the book. He is the director of the Mendocino Institute and a fellow in environmental history at UC Berkeley. And joining us from Detroit on the phone is Mike Hamlin, founder of the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. And Mike has been waiting patiently on the phone. I wonder if you could give us a sense of how did the larger things going on in the country around civil rights affect the workers' movement as you saw it, Mike?
You know, at the time, we didn't understand fully everything that was going on and why it happened. But what happened to us was in the 50s, we began to, you know, and when I say we, I'm saying basically young black intellectuals and working class leaders begin to understand our position in America. You know, this country is covered with layers and layers of falsehoods about it, the reality of the country and its institutions and documents and so forth. And we began to understand that, and we understood our plight in terms of how what a horrible life we have had in this country, and we didn't know what to do about it. At the same time, the civil rights movement was going on in the South, and we, you know, here in Detroit, we looked at the murder and the beatings and the rape and plunder of the South, historically and at the time, and we grew angry, and further, you know, we began to see the worldwide movement for independence in the colonies, and we began to identify with the Third World and with the writers in the Third World. And we began to ask ourselves, we first of all knew that we had to struggle for change. And secondly, in order to do that, we had to study people who had engaged in struggle in situations like ours, and we had to develop capability of understanding and analyzing the society so we could determine how to move strategically. And we the 50s was a period of awakening and a great study beginning back in early 50s with you know, at the time, the Black Arts Movement was bringing forth poets and writers, and we're reading books like Invisible Man and some of Leroy Jones' stuff, and discovering Du Bois and Fanon, et cetera. And so what you do when you're in a situation like that and you're conscious and you're angry and you won't change, you ask yourself a couple of things. One, who can I look for for leadership in terms of how to wage your struggle. And secondly, first and foremost, where is the main force for what you need? And that would be that which would constitute a vanguard of leadership, and one that was placed strategically in the system to deliver a blow. And that, to us, was black workers, the vanguard, and at the point of production.
So tell us about the context in which the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement appeared. What was the situation in the factories of the auto industry in Detroit in the late 1960s?
Okay. In the plants, of course, blacks had moved in when Kennedy came in and introduced Keynesian economics. It provided an opportunity for white workers to move into the better jobs in industry, and that meant it opened jobs for blacks coming here from the South and already here to move into, as Cal said, the hardest working, dirtiest jobs. And so there was a mass influx of black workers, young black workers, into the plants. Now, all of us, you know, we were earning pretty good pay. I wasn't in auto. I worked for the Detroit News, as a matter of fact, in circulation. But all of us were looking at what went on in the South. And it was torturous to witness. You know, I can think now about how people in this country from foreign lands who are under attack by the U.S., how they must feel when see that people being killed by bombs and so forth. And that was the thing that affected us. So, you know, over a period of time, we figured out certain things. The Panthers were out in L.A., and they believed that direct confrontation with the police based on the youth that they recruited, and SNCC had gone through nonviolence. Our people could not, and I maintain this is a class thing, couldn't adapt to nonviolence. I never even considered it, and most of my comrades didn't consider it, but we did support the people in the South. We raised money and supplies. At any rate, over a long period of time, we were trying to figure out what to do. We came to that conclusion about the working class. Now, we had these discussions and debate with SDS people about they said the working class had no revolutionary potential.
And SDS being the Students for a Democratic Society, a mainly white student movement.
Yeah, which eventually split into two groups, at least, and one that did go to the working class. But we had this argument with them, and we said we were going to demonstrate it. And, and what we did was we began working. We had started a newspaper. And from beginning, our commitment was going to the working class, in particular black workers. We started a newspaper called Inner City Voice, and it recruited people who were looking for the same things that we were looking for. Now, if you recall that time, it was one thing for people to subject themselves to torture and death and jail and prison in the South based on nonviolence. It was another thing to go to the working class, which had been stymied is not the word, had been traumatized by McCarthyism, and not only in the working class, the workers, but the leftist organizations, the CP, et cetera. There were a couple of them, Socialist Workers Party at PL, Progressive Labor, mm-hmm. who were open, but most they were in hiding and not taking a leading role. You couldn't go into the plant and pass out a radical or communist document at that time. So, but what you had in the people, in us and the people around us, were people who were willing to do what people have to do to build a radical movement. And that is, they have to be willing to risk everything. They can't live the same way anymore. And that was where we were. We didn't care what would happen. Now, our literature made it clear to the workers that we were prepared to fight and to fight to the end in any way that we could. And we did, we were not concerned about jobs. Most of us had jobs at that time, but it didn't really matter. Most of us had families, but we had to wage this fight. And that willingness and the willingness to take the risk brought these workers to us.
So how were you received, and what sort of actions did the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement take, and what did it inspire?
Okay, well, we were warmly received because these workers, these black workers in the plant, not only had to deal with the issues that Cal brought up about speed up, compulsory overtime, you know, the dirtiest and most dangerous jobs. I could, you know, we don't have time, but I could recount some horrendous incidents that took place in the 60s in these plants as a result of the speed up, the overtime, and the dangerous conditions, and so forth. But we were warmly received because we were there at the picket line, I mean, at the gate, with our literature, with our militant, you know, radical literature, given handed to the black workers as they go in. And so what happened was there were things going on in the plant that ultimately led them to want to strike. And the, basically, the strike was by the black workers, the first Wildcat strike, which was in 68, was by the black workers, and it raised issues that were primarily the issues of the black workers, but also class issues, you know, including things like speed up and work rules and control of the shop floor. But, you know, we had slogans, we had demands in there about black foremen, black and we did not exempt the UAW. We, you know, one of our principal slogans was UAW means you ain't white. so we had this strike. We only called on the black workers to strike, and they did. And, you know, they came out, and I think it was about 3,000 of them. And, you know, we held a mass meeting, and they, you know, and they, you know, and we struck, I think, for 3 days. And, you know, and changes were made. Obviously, you know, they understood that they had to accommodate to some extent. But we also got involved in fighting the union for leadership. And they stole, they, you know, they stuffed the black ballot box. And, you know, we didn't win, but we won by what we accomplished in that process in terms of the understanding of the workers. That inspired workers around the city. And we began to develop units, revolutionary union movements in various plants in the area, including the Chrysler Ellen Axle plant, which not long after we struck that plant on the basis of blacks demands of these black workers. And interestingly enough, 25 people got fired from that in that situation. And we, of course, provided support and, you know, helped them through that period because we, the other thing I should say about this, and I always argue that the reason why we were successful, we represented a just cause, and a just cause enjoys abundant support because we got support from, just like the civil rights movement did, from all kinds of people, including people in high places at Chrysler and at the UAW, you know, in clandestine support. But from people in strange places that gave us some support. Now, this electrified, I believe, the workers, black workers across the country, because we start hearing from people everywhere, and we begin to link up with, we ultimately got linked up with the people from SNCC, who had began the Black Power Movement. And you know, we formed the League of Revolutionary Black Workers because we had any number of plants. We had a student-wide city citywide student organization. We had community organizations, you know, and we had units in other cities, in other plants. In the South, we did some organizing in Nashville and New Orleans and Birmingham, Atlanta. And so we had units all around the country.